Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. I'm your host, John Orlando, bringing you the only podcast that's live and indirect from Providence, Rhode Island, via the capital city of Ohio, Columbus, Ohio. Hey, it's been a long, long time since I've been on the airwaves, and I'm so happy to be back on the airwaves. There's a lot of stuff that's been going on with me, which I'll just mention. You know, there was a trip back to Rhode Island. For those of you that follow me on social media, you know that I've been kind of out and about. My mother had a yard sale. I was up in Rhode Island. I was hanging out for a while, helping her with that. I also had a couple of, I guess you could say, snafus with some of my guests that were planning on coming on the PVD Cast, and then somehow we just never got connected, I guess. So another reason why I haven't been out on the airwaves, and, you know, quite frankly, too, you know, I'm pretty much an open book on this podcast, but I think for right now, I don't wish to talk about it. Maybe I will later. There's been some personal issues going on with yours truly, and I don't want to get into it because it's very messy and it's very, very long, too, to be honest with you. I mean, I have a great guest coming on here, Terry W. Irvin II. He is an author. He has got 6 books that have been published, all by Graphon Wood Press, and they're available on Amazon, Barnes & Nobles. They're available all over the place. Pretty much delving into just the genres of fantasy and science fiction, but Terry's coming on to talk about the writing process and about just being an author. And actually, he's a very unique character because he has a jack-of-all-trades type of background, if you will. And we'll talk a little more about that. But some of his books, by the way, I didn't mention. Flank Hawk, Blood Sword, Relic Tech, Relic Hunted, Genre Shotgun, which is another short story in the anthology. But he's got a lot of stuff to say about the writing process, about being an author. And I'm glad that we got the opportunity to sit down and we got the opportunity to talk. And, you know, hey, that's what I like to do on this podcast, sit down with great guests and talk with them. So with that being said, going back to what this original train of thought was, I don't want to spend 15-20 minutes talking about my personal woes. It just was a hard time for me, and there are some folks that are probably listening to this and know exactly what I'm talking about, but maybe on a future podcast I'll talk a little bit about it. But so, you know, with that being said, you know, a vacation, personal issues, a lack of guests. That's why it's been a while since I've been out here with a new episode, but I'm here, number 95, and I'm going to throw it out there. I'm going to talk about it. There's a couple of things that I need your help on. That's right, I do. I need your help. Okay, the first thing is that I discovered while on vacation that the theme song that I currently use for this particular podcast is being used by another company, another wrestling-oriented company, and that's all I'm going to say. And I know it seems really silly, but I don't like that idea. I don't like the idea that my podcast theme music is the same as something else, especially when that something else is probably, in a quite honest, straight up, keeping it 100, if you will, that other product is probably much more well-known than the PVD Cast. you know, I do have an ego, but I'm also realistic to know, all right, that the PVD Cast is a niche for a few folks, but eventually, hopefully, it'll be a powerhouse brand, but I digress. So I'm looking for some new music. So I'm going to challenge some folks out there. If you know of some great new music out there, a band, shoot me an email, johnorlando@pvdcast.com, or tweet me at pvdmvp. Let me know about the band, where I can get in touch with them and whatnot, and maybe we can work something out where the PVD Cast can have its own unique introduction, or its own unique intro song, if you will. So that's one thing that I need help from you, the avid listeners. The second one is, we're coming up on episode 100, and I want to make it a big frickin' deal. That's right, I do. Because I've been doing this podcast for 100 episodes. Right now, 95 episodes, excuse me. But I will be doing it for 100 episodes, because I have some folks lined up. Who would you like to see me sit down and chat with for the 100th episode? All right? Now, obviously, let's keep it, you know, within the realms of actuality, I don't think Donald Trump is going to come on my podcast. I'm not even sure that I would want him on my podcast. I don't know. I mean, maybe. I think it would be a challenge for me to sit here in the same room with Donald Trump or to sit across the computer via Skype with him. But nonetheless, I mean, throw out some ideas. I'd like to hear what you, the listener, would like to hear on episode 100 of the PVD cast. Like I said, I can't believe that I've been doing this for going on 4 years. 95 episodes as of now. I guarantee that I'm going to reach 100. I don't know. Hell, I'd like to reach 300. Who knows? Just actually, by the way, in full disclosure, just renewed my contract with Bluehost to have pvdcast.com out there, which the numbers are looking pretty darn good, despite the fact that I've been like 3 weeks in between episodes. But nonetheless, so I appreciate everybody listening. And if you listen, tell a friend. If you just discovered this podcast, tell a friend. You know, tweet it, Vine it, Snapchat it, Facebook it, whatever. Tell folks about it. Because there's some big things coming up, I think, for this podcast. And I know I've said that before in the past, but I really think that there's some big things on the horizon here with the PVD cast. But, all right, with that, I have rattled on and on and on, and I want to get to our I want to get to my guest, Terry W. Irvin II, whom was recommended to me by Mr. Stephen Hines. And as you know, Stephen Hines has a great new memoir out called Rebirth Defect. And quite frankly, folks, it is a very humorous read. I highly recommend it. I mean, you know, it's Stephen's experiences with various different religions, trying to find out the truth, trying to find out how the world works. And Stephen wrote them all down for your reading pleasure. That's Rebirth Defect. It's his memoir. It's available all over the place. But if you just need a very simple place where you can get information about it, well, let me just tell you, just go to stephenhines.org. That's his website. STEPHENHINES.org. That's right. I'll spell it out for you, as Big Cass would say. Just head on over there. That's where you can find out about Rebirth Defect, his memoir, and his experiences of religion. So with that being said, let's get on into a quick musical interlude. And on the other side of that break, we're going to talk to Terry W. Irvin II. All right, ladies and gentlemen, John Orlando here sitting down with Terry W. Irvin II. Terry, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing pretty good.
That's
good. How about you?
I can't complain. I cannot complain. We're here in Marysville at the Public Library, which is a very nice facility, I must say.
It is.
Yeah.
It's very nice. And it's friendly people, too.
Right. And you must be at home because you write books. There's lots of books on the shelves. And so you must just be in heaven.
Yeah. Well, libraries are cool.
Well, let's talk about some of the novels that you've written. And you have 3 fantasy novels and then 2 science fiction novels and then kind of a short story anthology.
Right.
So let's talk real quickly about the fantasy novels, Flank Hawk, Blood Sword, and Soul Forge. Do you want to give the listeners at home like kind of a brief summary of what those tales are about?
Sure. Flank Hawk and Blood Sword, Soul Forge are part of the First Civilization's Legacy series.
Okay.
And so it's a series that is not ended. You know, it's not like a trilogy.
Okay.
And anyways, it's a post-apocalyptic fantasy series, and it takes place about several thousand years in the future where magic actually exists and some remnant technology. And if you ever look at the covers, you like especially for Flank Hawk and Blood Sword, you can kind of see like buildings in the background mm-hmm. or airplanes or helicopters and things like that. And basically what it is it the series follows Krish, who started out as a farmhand, became a mercenary after joining the militia. His village was being overrun by the Necromancer King. He's taken under the wing of a mercenary, Rotoad, and then the story takes off from there. You know, he gets caught up in a whirlwind of events, and it's just kind of an exciting action adventure story. You know, the main character, his mercenary name becomes Flank Hawk, and he's not like some kind of superhero with a sword. He's just kind of an average guy that just kind of tries to get through. and you know, loyalty and friendship and
do you
and
think,
sacrifice.
If I may interject, yeah. Do you think that's what makes it more challenging to write, the fact that he's not a superhero, so to speak, that he's just an average guy facing very unordinary type of circumstances and how he overcomes? Do you think that that's what's
yeah,
the challenge
I think,
behind
I think,
it?
I think that a lot of readers appreciate that. I mean, because he's not like Superman coming in. He's not some kind of sword master whips his way through. You know, he's competent with a spear and things like that. One of the other things is odd is that he's like a neophyte healer. But in the world that I created, the magic that you're able to do affects who you are. If you are a healer of any merit, it affects your ability to actually do physical violence. Powerful healers actually have guards that protect them because okay. They're unable to do it, and that does affect him somewhat. If you are a seer, mm-hmm. eventually your eyesight deteriorates until you're totally blind. The more powerful you become,
okay,
things like that.
Okay,
so if you would happen to be a necromancer, that doesn't work out very pretty for you.
No, I don't think so. So taking a look, you mentioned the covers. You know, I took a look at the various different covers that you have for these novels on your website. Who did the artwork for it? Do you work in conjunction with an artist to create that, or is that something that your publisher provides for you? How does that work?
My publisher is Griffinwood Press, and Christine Griffin has done the artwork for most of my novels.
Okay.
And basically what had happened was my publisher had said, hey, these are some of the people we're looking at for doing covers for your novels.
Okay.
And I said, I worked at Mind Flights, which was a magazine, e-zine, as an editor. Mostly I read Slush. And Christine had competed. She had turned in some a picture for one of the competitions, came in second. I liked her stuff, and I told my publisher, said, hey, why don't you look at this lady and see what she does? And from there, that's what happened.
Okay.
That's how she was selected. And then, yes, I, unlike, with one of the advantages with a small publisher as compared to a large publisher is that with large publishers, very often they just assign an artist. You may not even know who it is until it's there. You don't have any input on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
That very often happens, especially when you're a new author. This is what I've been told.
Okay.
But with this, I was able to was in contact with Christine, and you know, she, you know, we went kind of back and forth, and she would send some examples to me, and I would say mostly I just said great.
Okay. Everything. So she did the covers for all of your books
except for the last one, which would be Relic Hunted.
Okay.
And another artist did it for that, and that's just my publisher picked the
okay.
artist, and you know, and it, just the way life goes.
I gotcha. Well, let's talk about the two science fiction novels you have created, Relic Tech and Relic Hunted.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to just briefly paraphrase
sure.
what those are about?
Sure. That's they're part of the Crax War Chronicles, and it's set about 150 years in the future, and it follows Krakisa Kisei, who's a fourth class security specialist. And he is a relic tech, which means he relies on like 1990s technology in the future, which is kind of odd. And it's just kind of you learn why and stuff as you read the books and things. But one of the things that brought that to mind was back when I was thinking about writing the book, I was thinking about disparities
mm-hmm.
in cultures and people
sure.
and,
mm-hmm.
and money. And I thought in the future, the access and use of technology would be a big disparity. And so that kind of was the impetus. He's a fourth class security specialist, which you can only be classified that as if you're relic tech.
Okay.
If you're intermediate tech or iTech, then you start out at third class and
okay.
move up. And
okay.
so, you know, there's, but, you know, some of it is, he's competent in interfacing with computers and he knows about the technology. He just doesn't rely on it. And he's kind of got a chip on his shoulder. He's kind
mm-hmm.
of fun to write like that. He's kind of a jerk in a lot of ways.
Okay.
And he knows it. And, but, you know, he just doesn't want to have people put him down, but, you know, sometimes goes out of his way to get into situations.
Well, real quickly, you know, three things popped in my head while you were talking about that. So Was there particular pieces of technology you had in mind that you wanted him, and maybe we're giving away a little bit of the story, but was there pieces of technology from the past that you go, yeah, that's got to be in this story? Like, did you go, ah, fax machines? You know?
No, no.
You know, or no, just, or no, well, there was nothing like that? Or
World War One, they used shotguns and bayonets.
Right.
That's what he carries around with him, a shotgun and a bayonet. And so, and you know, he tells some character, he said, you know, any alien, you know, that's going to impress him. And he says, how would you know? Have you ever met an alien?
Right.
You know,
okay.
And you know, stuff like that. But you know, that's just, it's just his attitude. He gets the job done. He says, look, shotguns are still used in penal colonies. It's good enough for me. On a ship, I'm not going to shoot through anything important.
Okay.
You know, bulkhead. You know, that's his attitude. And you know, the story actually starts out with him in a hospital bed on trial for heinous crimes that he's committed. And he has no idea. He's kind of lost part of his memory. He can't remember what's going on, but he knows he's being set up. And so he ends up, he has a very vague knowledge of the court system and stuff, just from his narrow perspective. And so anyways, he gets it maneuvered so that he has his brain hooked up to the experimental cranial tar, which probes his mind, and it will download his memories. And his attitude is, well, if I did it, the cranial tar is going to, it scrambles your brain anyways, as it does it. So he's going to die anyways, his wounds, but anybody who is bringing him down, he figures they'll get caught. And so I'll get paid back that way in the end.
So it's kind of a mix of things.
Yes.
You use some things from the past that you knew about and some things that you created
or
that, you know,
obviously
has been discussed too.
And I used 90s technology when I first started writing this. I said, you know, a lot of science fiction novels go out of date.
Right.
And I figured if this guy's using 90s technology, it's never going to go out of date. And some things that are in it, you know, like they use computer clips, which are like your little iPads.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, and that would, but, you know, glowing a tropical fish.
Okay.
Back in the 90s, it wasn't there. Now you've got it.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
So actually, I thought it'd take a little longer.
Okay. Okay. So talking about the technology aspect, and just, you know, we talked off air real quick about, you know, your political endeavors, if you will, and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is a disparity even today in terms of technology among individuals in society? Because I will say this, I think there is, and I think people don't think that. I think that most modern people will go, oh, everybody's got an iPhone, everybody's got a computer, everybody. But I don't believe that that's true. I believe from my own experiences that that's not true. What's your opinion?
I think there is a disparity, and yeah, some people have iPhones, but really, what I think about is technology that can help you in your career and your life. Yes,
sure.
An iPhone can do that, but do you know how to manipulate and work software? Okay, you know, what is your knowledge of working with computers and information? If you want to be an auto mechanic, it's more than a set of tools anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you want to be a machinist in manufacturing, it is more than just sitting on a lathe anymore. It's all, you know, CNC, you know, it's all.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So access to computers and that knowledge is really important.
And I don't think I ever thought about it that way. You know, that your ideas, I never thought of it that way, because you bring a valid point to the table that it's easy to make all kinds of Instagram photos, but where's that going to lead in life, you know?
I mean, there are careers that's useful, but it's limiting.
It's limiting,
And just like anything else, you know, you're in education a little bit. I am. It's also how you use the technology.
Sure.
You know,
exactly.
How many kids don't get to read? How many of those kids have their, you know, as a 4 or 5 year old have the Kindle or the iPad or the books that they can use to read from, and so they're at a disadvantage.
Correct.
To start with.
Correct. Do you think that personally we in 2016 rely too much on technology?
Yeah.
Okay.
I do. I'm a high school teacher, and I think sometimes kids are too connected to that. The interpersonal communication skill is lacking a lot of times.
Sure.
And that's important. I mean, somebody breaks up with their girlfriend from 2 years, how do they do it? In an Instagram or a text?
Right.
Okay.
No,
you know, that kind of stuff. You know, I kind of dread the day that we get a solar flare and it messes up the...
Our electronic grid and whatnot.
Yeah. You know, the satellites.
Sure.
And, you know, then you're texting, your cell phone's connection is going to be down. It's going to be kids like having nicotine fits.
Exactly.
Because when I'm a little bit, it is not so much, you know, I'll leave my phone at home by accident and I kind of say, oh man, that kind of sucks. But I'm not like...
You don't have a panic attack over that.
No, but right, yeah. But I've seen kids who have left their phones at home and...
Yeah,
it's agitating.
Sure, I think it's just like anything else. It's moderation.
Yeah, you know? I mean, there's one teacher I was working with, and she accidentally left her phone on, and so a text came in, and she just laid it down, turned it off, said I'm sorry, laid it down, and the kids could hardly believe that she didn't have to look to see who it was, and they were more concerned about you're not going to look. But then again, you know, you can. That's a downside, but then. The social media, the interconnectedness and stuff like that is a distinct advantage. And if the kids can use it right, it's awesome.
Right.
But a lot of my students have had trouble keeping jobs because, you know, you're on the job on the work site. They don't want you pulling your phone out.
Yeah, right. Exactly. For safety reasons, for productivity.
But it's only 30 seconds.
Yeah, but that, yeah. No, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. Yeah, so.
No, you know, but that's a kid's argument.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just looked at it. Right. Well, that's what you got a break for.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, let's get back on track. Let's talk about writing.
That's okay.
You also had a short story anthology called Genre Shotgun, in which you wrote a variety of different short stories featuring a lot of different themes. So how did that come about? Because, I mean, you're going from obviously you like to write fantasy and sci-fi, and then you went to a variety of different genres within this anthology. So how did that novel come about?
Well, writing, I first wrote Relic Tech, and then I sent it out to try and find publishers, and then I wrote Flying Hawk.
Okay.
And finding a publisher, excuse me, can take quite a while.
Okay.
And so I started to write some short stories because I didn't want to write the second book in the series until I could sell the first.
Smart marketing.
And so
move.
I wrote some short stories, and they're just different ideas that I came up with.
Okay.
Okay. And some of them are inspirational stories. Some of them are kind of horror suspense and some science fiction. I didn't write any short story fantasy. I just didn't come up with ideas for it. And when you come up with ideas for writing, you know, most of the time when I get an idea, I'll think about it a while. I'll put it in a little file. But you don't know right away whether it's a short story length idea or whether it's a novel length idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so these happen to be the short story ideas. Like I had one where a guy, it's called Tethered in Purgatory. And it's about a guy who gets Lou Gehrig's disease and he has his body cryogenically frozen until they can find a cure. And he finds out when he's there, his soul is tethered to his body. He can see heaven, he can hear, but he can't leave his body. He's tethered to it, and that's what the story is about. What happens? What does he do? You know, so, but that wasn't a novel length story.
Sure.
And what I did was I sold all those novel or short stories, excuse me, to magazines, anthologies, e-zines, and then when the rights reverted to me, my publisher put them together in a collection.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And published them.
Okay.
And so that's what it was. I can say of all the things that I've sold, or all the books, it sells probably the least.
Oh.
And short story collections tend to do that. Even famous authors, usually their collections do. I don't know why. It's just they don't sell as well. Huh. But I sell more print copies than I do ebook copies.
Okay.
And
that's
such,
weird. That's interesting.
You know, but like if I'll go to like a signing event,
okay.
Sometimes I will sell 5, 6, 7, 8 copies of those and maybe one or two of the this novel and that novel. And so it just depends on where you are in the readership. But overall, it just doesn't sell as well. And I kind of knew that, and my publisher kind of knew that. But it was enough to make a profit.
And
the editing and stuff was mostly done.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Low overhead, if you will.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, one of the things I will talk about more as well, you've... authored quite a few blog posts for various different blogs, and one of the ones that I stumbled across was one entitled "Are You Really Writing Part 2?" where you said, and here's a prime example of it: don't wait, you know, keep writing no matter what it is. And I guess that's where that came into play with these short stories: is you're waiting on a publisher to say yes or no, and I assume that some authors may just sit on their laurels and just not continue to write and continue to stay in practice and continue to do that. So I found that very interesting. That's very wise advice, I think.
Yeah, and whether you're going to self-publish or you're going the more what they would call traditional route, some people call it corporate publishing, whatever, one of the things that very often is asked of you, and my publisher asks this, and I know other authors have gone, what else have you got? What else are you working on? And so if you have one thing and you haven't done anything else and you're just banking on that one book, it, you know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. But also, that one book may not be very good if it's your first novel, okay? It took me a long time to write Relic Tech because it went through a lot of revisions and I learned as I was going. And so it's a really good book. It's probably so far my best-selling novel. It's sold the most copies. But, you know, sometimes, you know, there's a saying, some authors will say you have to sell or write a million words before you're good enough. And I don't know if that's true or not. But I think that you definitely learn. And your first book, you learn from, like in the First Civilizations Legacy series with Flankhawk, I can look back at the first novel a little bit and see, well, I could have done that a little bit better because I'm a better author. Just like, you know, in baseball, in your career, you know, your rookie careers, you know, you're not going to make those same mistakes.
Yeah, you know? or making your own podcast.
Yeah, that could be it too.
But yeah, definitely I think it doesn't matter what you're doing. I think that you should strive to be better and that you can always look back and go, God, I could have done that better, I could have done this better. Let's talk for a minute about the writing process.
Okay.
So how important is brainstorming for you when you sit down to start a tale, to start a story, to maybe pick up where you left off with another novel? And I think you hinted a little bit about it. What's the process for brainstorming for you?
Okay, I don't know where you're going with that a little bit, but there's two different answers to that. First off, I think about if there's an idea. That's usually where I come from, idea.
Okay.
Some kind of mix up or mashup. With Flankhawk, what it was I was driving home from work, and I do a lot of thinking then. And basically, I was rereading a couple of novels. I was rereading the World War series by Harry Turtledove, which is aliens invading the Earth during World War II.
Okay.
And there was a disparity in technology. And I was also re-listening to Roger Zelazny's The Guns of Avalon. And Prince Corwin brings in, learns how to get gunpowder to function in the magical city of Amber where it normally doesn't happen. And so I said, I kind of wonder what would happen if a dragon would encounter a World War II aircraft. I've never read that. And so that's, you know, I just kind of put it together with that. And so I kind of mash things together.
Okay. So that it starts with an idea.
I came up with the world where that could happen, the plot line, and then the characters that would tell the story came last. Now, one of the things that you kind of talked about, the next story, what I do when I finish a novel that I know is going to be a series is I will write, if I have an idea, the next chapter or two of the next novel, even if it gets a lot changed.
Okay.
Because what happens, and if you've ever written or if you've ever done anything, looking at a blank piece of paper
can be daunting,
especially if you haven't been with the story for a year or so or more. And so for me, it's easier. You can pick up with it. You can take off. You've got the voice. You've got the character, and you've got it started. And that's for me. And I jot down ideas and I just keep the ideas in files, and I'll open them up and add to them when something comes to me. Because one of the things that sometimes I hear on like forums, other writers say, I get so many ideas, I just can't focus on one. I can't. And, you know, you got to have that self-discipline. So what I do is I get a good idea. I don't want to lose that thought. So I put it in a file somewhere, and I can come back to it. But the thing is, ideas are a dime a dozen or a dollar a dozen. It's actually taking those and finishing a story.
Okay.
And writing it.
And now, so when you have that idea, you've sussed out some of the rough ideas to what you want to present in that novel. Like, then you start writing. I guess this is one of the things coming from their educational backgrounds is I'm always preaching to my students, you know, writing is a process. So you have rewriting, you have editing and that. So how much of that do you feel is crucial to your success with these novels? Is your rewriting, your editing, your proofreading, etc.?
A lot.
I
probably have gone through the novel in its completion, the last one, Relic Hunted, 10 times.
Do you ever have a second set of eyes take a look at it?
Yes.
You do?
Okay. You know, sometimes I have readers read it.
Okay.
Okay, and they'll say, you know, this spot here doesn't make sense. It can be other authors, or it can be just somebody who, or a couple people who are really good at reading, who've well read. And they may not be able to tell you what's wrong or how to fix it, but they say, he just doesn't seem like he's doing what he should be doing here.
Those kind of things. So like a focus group, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay. And so, you know, you can use those people to help direct you. And of course, then I have a publisher. Mm-hmm. And who looks the stuff over too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have a publisher now. But just because, you know, he's taken my stuff before and I've done well, doesn't mean he'll take the next novel because it's a business for him.
Sure.
You know, and so, and then I also have an editor, and they do just more than line editing where they say, okay, there's a typo here.
Okay. You misspelled, you use the wrong
word. You know, there's other stuff where they will put in where, you know, they'll put input and say, you know, I think the characters, the dialogue here is off. You know, this is in other instances, this is how the character spoke, I think, is off.
Okay.
And you get blind to that.
Sure. Yeah.
That stuff.
Yeah, most definitely. So let's talk a little bit. How did you get interested in writing? Like, when did you know, I like this, I want to keep doing this, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I was told myself in college someday I'd write a novel. And then, you know, in the late 90s, I said, you know, I'm getting kind of older. I probably ought to get on this. And so that's really what I decided to do because, you know, it wasn't going to get done. And writing a novel is hard. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you can just whip out in 45 minutes. Now, there are some authors and writers who are much more prolific. They write faster than I do. Some that write slower. But it's a time commitment, and there's no guarantee of success at the end. Mm-hmm. Even if you self-publish, it's out there, but that doesn't mean anybody's going to want to read it.
Right.
So, you know, you can submit to publishers, and they may not want it, or try to get an agent. That's another route who will try to sell it for you. So there's no guarantee of success. And that's the first thing to realize. You kind of have to like it and enjoy it, although it is work.
Mm-hmm. Do you set aside a specific, because I've read where some authors will go, they get up in the morning and they go from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. That's my time to
No,
write.
I don't do that.
You don't do that?
Okay. No, I fit it in. I fit it in when I can.
Okay.
Like if I wasn't doing the podcast today, I'd probably be doing a little bit of writing.
Okay.
Okay. Right. But you know, things get in the way.
Sure. Life gets in the way.
you set priorities. It just can't be the bottom priority. Like yesterday, I took my daughter to the Air Force Museum. Okay. I could have spent that time writing. I chose. Last week, I took my other daughter to the art museum in Toledo. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I could have said, no, we're not going to do that. I'm going to sit and write. So I make it a priority, but it's not the priority.
I've got
a job. I'm a teacher.
Sure.
That's more important. I'm a village councilman. I have to do my research, get my packet, do all that. You know, you got priorities that you set.
So, I got you. No,
but
I get
you can't put it, because if you don't make it a priority, it's never going to get done. One of the things that I want to say is, what the advice I'm giving, that's not a guarantee. There's not one way to do it.
Right, no.
Okay, correct. If there was one way to do it, to write it, every successful author would be doing it that
correct.
Way. And Stephen King does it different from J.K. Rowling.
Patterson does it a different way, et cetera,
you know,
et cetera.
But it's what works. Sure. But there are certain things that are wrong, obviously, that you know, and I just said one. If you don't, if it's your bottom priority, mm-hmm. unless you have nothing else going on in life, it's not going to get done.
Yeah, so, you know, I totally agree that, you know, you have to balance life. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, at the beginning of this podcast, when I opened it and did the intro, I explained I've been 3 weeks in between episodes because just life got in the way, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that I agree with you wholeheartedly. You just got to make that commitment and fit it in wherever. Why science fiction and fantasy? Like, what intrigues you about those? Are you a fan of those genres to begin with?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think a lot of writers write books that they'd like to see on the shelf
okay.
if they didn't write them themselves. And that's me, okay? That was the first thing that motivated me to write,
okay.
you know, and helped to guide me. Plus, kind of like what I said, you're going to spend a lot of time with that book.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of, hopefully you like the story. There are some people who, for example, romance is a very popular genre,
mm-hmm.
okay? It sells better if you look at some of the numbers than like science fiction
okay.
in some ways.
Okay.
You know, there's let's say a larger reader base out there, but I just don't care to read it. It's not terrible. There's nothing wrong with it.
Your cup
it's
of tea. Not. Right.
And so, you know, I guess if I was totally mercenary, I could try to do it, but I don't know if I'd do it very well either. Mm-hmm. So I think, and that's another reason why people ask, you know, do you reread your books? And I'm like, no, I don't just sit down and say, man, I haven't read Flying Hawk for a while. I haven't read Bloods. I'm going to reread that because I've read it so many times. Mm-hmm. I will go back to parts to make sure, you know, because it's a series
sure.
and I got to keep things consistent. What I do like is they're in audiobook form, and it's kind of neat to listen to somebody read your book to you. That's kind of cool.
You enjoy
yeah.
that?
Yeah, I like okay. that. I listen to a lot of audiobooks because part of it is I don't have as much time to read as I would like, and audiobooks can fill in. I'm driving home. Here, yeah. I'm driving here to Marysville.
Okay.
I listen to an audiobook.
Yeah. You know, let's talk about that. I kind of overlooked that. Is there more in store for your two series that you have going on?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. With Flying Hawk, and actually there was somebody on Flankers, which is like a Facebook group,
okay.
that some fans for the first Civilization's Legacy series they started, which is kind of neat.
I was going to say, that's got to be cool for you.
Yeah,
man.
I mean, it's not a huge group,
yeah,
but you know,
still,
it's got like 50 people in it.
But no,
that's
kinda, I get what you mean.
Anyways, one of them just finished Soulforge, and he's like, I think it's your best book yet. Is there any more coming? And because I'm working on another novel now,
okay.
it's, you know, the working title's Jack's Tale. It's a science fiction novel, Alien Invasion. It's a standalone.
Okay.
Okay, it's not going to be a series. And, anyways, he just was wondering, because I post about that sometimes, the writing progress. He says, I hope it kind of dovetails. And I told him no, but I do have at least two more books for that
okay.
series. And Relic Tech, you know, the first, and Relic Hunted, you know, the Cracks War Chronicles, I have at least two more books for that. I have actually written for that, like, the last scene that will ever be in the series.
Okay. And you put it in the file cabinet for right now?
Yeah, okay. It's in a file because I know what it
okay.
is. So, you know, there is a definite ending to it.
Okay. Do you like to write with an ending in mind? Do you already plan that out? Or does it just kind of, within, say, chapter 16, oh, in chapter 20, we're going to end it, this is how it's going to end? Or do you, when you first
start... You mean
start,
the book
go,
or the series?
Either or, like a book or a short story. Well, maybe not a short story, because you have to know that, but maybe in a book or a novel or a series, like, do you have an idea how it's going to end before, way before?
Yes, I do.
Okay,
when I write a novel, it's... I kind of map it out. It's kind of like a roadmap where you
sure.
Where you're going to go on vacation
okay.
and you mark all the places you're going to stop and
okay.
see and what's there and things
okay.
like that. Well, I plot out the novel like that, all the high points.
Okay.
I get from where I think it should start and where I think it should end. But just like a vacation, that doesn't mean that you don't say, hey, this is kind of neat over here. We're going
yeah.
to go see. We don't have time to do this. Or this isn't as cool as we thought. So we're not going to stay here very long. So it kind of changes. But I have a plan, and I know it's like a mile marker. I know
okay.
where I'm writing to. So when I sit down, I know what's where I've got to get to. And that helps me, I think, with not having writer's block.
Okay.
Because I know what I'm going
yeah,
to.
Yeah.
And if I'm a little stuck on how I want to say or change something, there's always editing. There's always marketing. There's always something else writing related to do and that. Now, with... my novels, I have an overall story arc, too.
Okay.
That I believe I know where it's going to end. It's not, the Flying Hawk series is not going to be 37 novels. Okay? And it's just, I don't see it becoming that.
Right.
Okay. Maybe there could be a spinoff with another character or something else in that world, but I don't see 37 novels in it.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't think he's got that much legs in his story.
Gotcha. So who are some of the authors you look up to? Some of your favorites.
That I go to?
Yeah,
to,
that you either enjoy or that you model your writing style after, if you will.
Well, first off, I think one of the best ways to learn to write is to read.
Sure.
But not just to only read for enjoyment. But if I get stuck, I go to see how certain authors did it. And then a couple authors, I'll take notes. I've read these books, reread them enough times, I know where to go. And I kind of watch and I say, okay, that's how they did it. And I do what those guys did, except I use my own writing style in the story. But it's like, you know, there's how-to books, how to write. They can give you the basics, but they can't get down into those mechanics. How do you character dialogue? How do you do a certain type of action scene? And Roger Zelazny is one of my favorites that mm-hmm. I go to, and Stephen Bruce. And I go to Harry Turtledove some. I've gone to Stephen R. Donaldson. Those are the ones that I've done a lot with the fantasy and the science fiction a little bit. They're the ones that I've really focused on. But, you know, I do a lot of reading and listening too, and that kind of helps you. Like, mm-hmm. I've been interested in the Kevin Hearn His Iron Druid Chronicles. Those are really interesting. I don't know.
Okay.
They're interesting e-books to listen to, or audiobooks to listen to as well. And, you know, so those kind of things mm-hmm. I kind of watch and listen to. There's like the Hard Luck Hank series by Stephen Campbell. He's kind of funny to listen to. And it gives you ideas. And the thing is, you know, I read some history. I do a lot of different things, because the wider your spectrum is, of just knowledge, the better off you're going to be as a writer. I don't just read or just pay attention to
science fiction and fantasy,
uh-huh. although it's a focus and it's an enjoyment.
Sure. Well, we talked a little bit about it. You also have provided different blogs with mm-hmm. Different input, as you mentioned, your opinions, your insights on writing. And I kind of went through a few of them, and I found these to be probably the most fascinating. And one of them we already talked about, but you wrote a particular blog entry called RPG, Experiences to Writing a Novel,
mm-hmm.
and it was about how role-playing games help you be creative. Could you maybe just explain a little more on that?
Sure. Well, see, if anybody does like role-playing games, you know, Traveller or Dungeons & Dragons
sure.
or anything like that,
you're right.
Basically, if you're a player, you're role-playing, and in a way, when you're sitting and you're writing a character, you're doing what they're not doing what you would do.
Mm-hmm.
You're writing them to do what they would do, mm-hmm. how they would respond, how they would react. And role-playing is kind of like that.
Sure.
Okay? And so that gives a writer a leg up, I believe, because they've played different characters. They understand. They can – and that helps.
Were you a Dungeons & Dragons guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I still – Once about every 3 or 4 months, some of my college friends will get together, and it's an excuse to get together, and we have fun. And the other thing is, as a game master, you have to create a world,
mm-hmm.
which is what basically you do as an author.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all kinds of things that are moving at once. You know, it's cause and effect is not one-to-one
mm-hmm.
always. And having that in mind when you're writing a novel, a lot of stuff that you create in writing a novel, and the histories, the backstory, the characters' backstories, all this stuff in the cities, 90% of it never shows up in the book. It just doesn't. You know, but if you set that foundation and that framework, you don't have to fill out every single name of every character and every person, every street in a
mm-hmm,
city.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have the basics there, then it's going to have that structure, that depth, and it's going to have that consistency.
Okay.
So that when I get to book 3 or 4, there's not going to be a reader who says, wait a second, in book,
book
one.
Book 2. Yeah. Right.
So, and there are some things that some readers have called me on, but there's a reason for it. It just hasn't been revealed. Like one of the, an air wizard, a lot of times when they become in the First Civilizations Legacy series, their hair turns white, their eyes turn white, they becomes translucent as they become more powerful. It kind of marks them. Well, one of the characters, their eye colors probably should not, it changes color from kind of white to a light bluish mm-hmm. later on. They don't really, you know, there's a reason behind it. And I'll reveal it here just on your podcast.
Sure. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, anyways, the character is doing that to conceal how powerful she is. And so
for all those people that pointed out, this is an error, Terry, you messed up.
Yeah, but
okay.
But you know, but so there's things that are going on that sometimes the readers don't see, but as long as there's a foundation mm-hmm. for it, that's what happens. She also colors her hair a little bit, so it's not as translucent. It's white.
And you know what? I guess that...
And there's
hints
to that in the book, but it isn't pounded out. Because, see, remember, I'm writing from Krish's or Flank Hawk's point of view. It's mm-hmm. a first-person point of view. Mm-hmm. It's what he observes and sees. Mm-hmm. He isn't in those other characters' heads.
Right.
And so that's kind of a limiting factor.
Okay. And I think that... I guess the reason why I found that blog interesting is because... of the fact that I guess I never thought of it that way, that all of those things that you do when you play that game or things that you do to create, you know, the Flank Hawk world and universe and whatnot. I also enjoyed this one, that you have a blog, and I don't remember what spot it was on or where it was on the internet, but Short Fiction Writer, What League Are You In?
Mm-hmm.
Where you compared the different levels to baseball to the different levels of writing.
And that really upset a lot of people.
Did it?
Yeah, I got a lot of emails and
really?
Stuff on that.
Why because would people take so much offense to that?
Because they felt it wasn't accurate, or they were at a different level and I was...
Demeaning them?
Really? Or, yeah. And basically what it was is basically saying, you know, you're at a different league. You know, you've got your... In baseball, you know, you got the minor leagues, you got
sure.
the Bush Leagues, the training all the way up.
Right.
And then, you know, there's double A,
triple A,
single A, and then you got the major leagues.
Right.
And, you know, Stephen King and all those
sure.
guys are in the major leagues.
They're the New York Yankees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And right. I consider myself now in the minor leagues. I am not up on their level. Yes, I'm professional.
Sure.
But I am not... You know, if you come along and J.K. Rowling or whoever, you know, says this is how you should do it, and I say this is how you do it, guess who you listen to?
Yeah.
Them. Because
yeah.
they're better writers than I am.
Sure.
Or they're more experienced. Maybe they've been a little bit luckier.
Uh-huh.
Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, but...
I would think...
But people took offense to that. Some
really?
People did. A lot of people... It was kind of funny. I was on a there was a Yahoo group, and the people were arguing about it. And you know, as an author, to a certain extent, you can't defend yourself very much,
right?
You know, I can say this is what I said and why, but you know, everybody's going to have their opinion. Just like as a writer, and somebody posts reviews of your book, you can't go out and yell at them, "You're wrong."
Well, you're right.
You know, the person read your book. You should be thankful for that. Second, not everybody is going to like your work. It's hard to say. You know, I write stories to entertain readers. I don't write stories so that people feel like they wasted their time or didn't enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're just not going to, everybody isn't going to like your work, and it's just the way it is. But if you go in there and try and defend yourself and say, well, my work is, that's just
my
not.
My work is excellent. You're
yeah,
an idiot.
Yeah,
yeah no, that, I get what you mean. Yeah.
Their points are valid,
mm-hmm.
or at least they're valid to them. I may not agree with them. But, you know, then again, people like my books. Maybe they like them for reasons I didn't even intend.
Sure. Here's another one that I thought was interesting. And the last blog that I read that I thought was really interesting is entitled Firearms and Fiction. And you brought up some very good points about when you are going to use weapons in your particular novel, they should be accurate in a way in which they should be used.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to explain a little more on that? And
well,
was that a controversial post?
No,
okay.
It wasn't. And
okay.
And it's just...
I don't mention that because of the current political climate that we are in now. And, you know...
And it depends on how you use it and the character.
Sure.
A police detective is going to know his firearm.
Correct.
Okay. Somebody who just somebody who bought a gun just to put in their desk drawer by the bedstand or whatever isn't going to know that much about it, possibly, if they don't get any training.
Sure.
And so the character's perception and what they say about it is important. But you know, if you're going to sit with a little snub-nosed revolver picking off people at 400 yards,
Well, number one, I don't even think that's accurate. You can't 400 yards with a snub nose. Right.
But
not happening.
I use an extreme example of it. It depends on the story, but you should be accurate with everything that you can be.
Okay.
And that's one example. But that's one where it's when you write fantasy and science fiction, readers suspend their disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if you start getting caught on things that you should have researched and you should know,
that disbelief is broken.
They're going to say, well, what else isn't this guy getting mm-hmm. right? And so you just basically the thrust of that was, if you're going to use firearms and they're important to the characters, it's integral to the story, try and be accurate with mm-hmm. it. You know, does a revolver have a safety? Okay. Yeah.
Those are all things that you should research and know.
And know a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't have to be a genius. You just have to. And part of the article was saying, if you don't know about a hunting rifle or a shotgun, ask somebody. You got an uncle who probably goes deer hunting.
Right.
Okay. Right. There are people who will share that information with you because they love the sport. Mm-hmm. They love. And so they're not going to sell you wrong, and they're going to do, you know, and it'll take you 10 minutes. That's worth it.
Or you even have the internet. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can Google, you know, how many rounds does a 12-gauge shotgun hold? You know, that certainly. Yep.
YouTube is very good. You got to watch your sources like and anything else. But, you know, just if you want to just see things, you know, anything.
Yeah.
I wrote down when on Facebook, I'm sitting using Google Maps
mm-hmm.
for my current novel because they're traveling a road I've never gone down. I'm going down that road and looking.
Really?
Yeah. So I can be pretty accurate.
And from the comfort of your own home. You don't have to go there.
I don't have to drive. Yeah. I don't have to sit and try and take pictures while I'm driving, which is kind of risky, or I don't have to drag somebody along to do it.
Right.
I went up to a park in Toledo that I hadn't been in 20 years. And I wanted to update it so it's accurate and correct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's changed in 20 years.
Yeah,
go figure.
Sure.
I mean, a lot the borders, but you know, just you want to be as accurate as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be perfect.
Okay.
But you want to do what you can when you can.
So, in your various different blogs that you write, you mm-hmm. give a lot of advice to folks in mm-hmm. terms of the writing process. So if I may ask, what's maybe the best piece of advice you've received about writing? I know I put you on the spot with that one.
It's one that I tend to tell people too. You got to finish what you write.
Okay.
If you never finish,
mm-hmm.
you're never, you know... I ran into one time at a writer's conference years ago, and this is what really struck it home. There was a lady who I was sitting at a table with, you know, we were eating breakfast and stuff, and she was wanting to pitch to agents, but she just wasn't ready yet. And most agents want to look at your first three chapters. She hadn't finished the book. She'd been working on the first three chapters of her novel for 4 years to get it perfect and right.
Ooh.
That's too long.
Yeah.
Finish the rest of the book. Come back and fix that later. But you're never gonna reach any measure of success, however you want to define it, if you at least never finish a book. And there are some people who will finish a book and rewrite it and continue to be concerned. And eventually you've got to say, it's done. I need to move on. I'll send it out, see what happens, and move on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was probably the best advice kind of I got. And that instance struck at home. I was like, I don't want to be that individual who keeps rewriting that novel. Relic Tech is a perfect example. I taught myself to write that novel. I plotted it out. It is a very long novel. It's like 180,000 words. For a first novel, it's really hard to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was part of the problem. It made it out of the slush pile at Tor.
Okay.
And then they looked at it and they sent it. They, you know, well, the guy had... The first editor looked at it, and he wrote a bunch of red marks on it and sent it back to me
mm-hmm.
and said, fix all this stuff, and then send it to this editor.
Okay.
And then it took about 18 months for them to decide, and then they wrote a nice letter and said, it's not for us. Send it to Bain because they do more military science fiction.
Okay.
But I learned when he wrote it was a better story because I went through and I fixed it.
Okay.
And it wasn't terrible stuff, but it was just little things.
Yeah.
And so then anyways... Bain, it went in the slush pile because I didn't go the agent route.
Okay.
And so that probably slowed everything down.
Sure.
But it made it out of their slush pile. made it past that guy, and then it languished a long time, and eventually they said no.
Okay.
And so then my current publisher said, well, if they're interested, I'll look at it. And he published it.
Okay.
So,
all right.
But
now, real quick, for folks that are listening at home, we've used that term quite a bit. Slush pile is kind of the open solicitation.
Yeah, it's unsolicited manuscripts.
Okay.
Thank you for saying that.
No, I just realized
you can get an agent.
Okay.
Who there are some publishers who will only accept stuff from an agent, or so they say. You know, and so you get an agent who represents your work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they negotiate the contracts, they do all that stuff for you.
Mm-hmm.
They take a cut of your profits or your how much your book sells. So their livelihood is behind getting good works,
mm-hmm.
but they have the connections. They know who is looking for what. I didn't go that route.
Okay.
Okay. Some people will tell you that it's harder to get an agent than it is to get a publisher.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Because you know they can only have so many clients.
That makes sense. And they want to make money off of you making money.
Right.
So they don't want every goofball coming in.
Yeah,
with
they
this,
can't. Yeah, and so they're selective who they want.
That makes sense. That makes perfect sense.
So where were we at?
Okay.
Well, anyways.
So that was the best piece of advice that you got.
Yeah,
was getting that particular first editor to hand it back to you and go, fix this.
And you don't know why something is rejected from a publisher. It could be just bad luck.
Sure.
In that, well, we just purchased something 3 months ago that's very similar to this.
Mm-hmm.
You're out of luck. It could be, I've just got too much stuff on my desk.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any more rooms in the publishing slot for the next year and a half anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Reject them.
Okay.
Okay.
It's
just a business.
Yeah, sure. And so your relationship with Griffin Wood has been very good.
I'd say it's pretty good. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes I annoy my publisher because I have a lot of questions. He's got patience with me, but he knows what he's doing,
mm-hmm.
and you know he hires the editors.
Mm-hmm.
He does all that stuff. He gets the stuff laid out. He does that for me. I guess I could do that if I wanted to self-publish, but I just don't.
Yeah,
I've got enough on my plate as it is, and so You know, I've done pretty well with him. I'm not his best author. I'm probably in the middle, maybe a little above the middle as far as sales go. But my books make a profit for him. They sell enough that he's not losing money on the venture.
Okay.
So that makes it worth it to him. Because, you know, I think a lot of people don't realize that early in their writing, they write a really good book, but the publisher also has to make a profit. They only have so many publishing slots available to them. You know, I would be wary of going with a publisher that is just shotgunning books out there because then they're not going to put much effort or work behind your book.
Yeah.
And so somebody needs to research their publisher before they submit to them.
Okay.
Read some of their books that they published because...
If the editing is bad,
it's going to be. And you can do some of that by looking at Amazon and going like the look inside and things. You can look at some of the sales records and stuff of a publisher and things like that. So, you know, you just got to do your research before you go. And then even then, if you're offered a contract, negotiate that contract. You don't have to take the boilerplate what they say. So you need to be up on contracts a little bit. And what helped me, I did publishing short stories. I had to look at a lot of contracts, you know, because an agent isn't going to represent you on that.
Right.
And you're not, I mean, if you're unsure, you can hire a literary attorney to help you, you know, and that may be worth it. But I felt pretty confident the contract from my publisher was a real basic one. It didn't have all kinds of thousands of clauses. And there's model contracts out there like the SFWA, Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. They have examples of model contracts.
Okay.
So you can see how it varies and things like that.
Okay. Well, let's switch gears real quick.
Sure.
Because we're getting close to about an hour. But let's talk real quick. You're also a councilman in your village. So given that it's an election year and we've heard a lot about politics, especially at the national level, what's your thinking about the current campaigns that are going on?
Oh,
the presidential
campaigns. From
your background of being in politics,
my experience isn't great. Vast.
Vast.
Or we'll put it that way. Well, I think that this, for me personally, looking at it, I think people, a lot of people are going to be voting and saying, this isn't the person I like, it's the person I dislike the least. You know,
do you think that that may trickle down to local political issues as well? I guess that's where I was going with this whole idea.
But I guess
if Democrats win the election and, you know, Hillary is the president, do you think that trickles down to the local level of Democrats?
Well, that for my position and the council, it's not Democrat Republican, and so it's not set up that way, which I kind of like. But I think that as far as like the congressional elections and stuff go, I think that who's up at the top of the ticket for each one, that does influence how things are going to go. I think there's a lot of turmoil. You can see that with Donald Trump probably going to be the Republican, and the insurgents or the impact that Bernie Sanders had had in, I think a lot of people are just dissatisfied. And they're looking for somebody to change it. And I think Donald Trump is what some people think will change it. And I think that they thought Bernie Sanders will change. Because let's face it, Donald Trump went up against, what, 16 or 17 different people. Okay. And Hillary didn't have nearly as many. Clinton. Okay. But for some reason, Bernie Sanders, the senator, caught on. And I think it's dissatisfaction. People are worried. People are stressed. They see, and for a whole different reasons. It can be economic. It can be jobs. It can be crime. It can be, there's just so many things that, and people are just, I think, on average, concerned. And they want somebody who they think is going to represent them. Now, we all know politicians say a lot of stuff.
They pander a lot,
You know, I think it's harder to do that at the local level. Because I go to the post office, I see people all the time. That's where a lot of people see me and give me their ideas. And then they tell me what they didn't like about what I'm thinking.
So it's a little more grassroots oriented.
You're right there. You know, whereas if you're in Washington, D.C., I think you're kind of isolated.
Most definitely.
You know, you're not, you know, you come back to your district how often, but even then, do you really go see people? So it's a little bit different. And I try to tell the students, and I sometimes present it to the government classes at my school, that the people, the local people you vote for, have a huge impact on your life too. You know, the news is always talking about the big, but in your local level, they have influence as well. Probably maybe what, you know, building permits, zoning, you know, local ordinances, all those things can affect you quite a bit.
Well, there you go. So with that being said, let's talk about a few things that are coming up on your schedule. Because next Saturday, the 16th of July, you're going to be at the 12th Annual Art Affair on the Square in Urbana, Ohio. So what is that, open to all different types of art, not just writers, but also painters and all types?
The library, the Champaign County Library, is sponsoring a tent. And so that's where I'll be.
All right. You'll be out there from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., right?
Yes, I will be. And I don't know the exact location, but I think it's close to the square where we've been every year that I've participated. I think I've been there 3 years. And so that's usually where it is. But they have people who do painting arts, glass arts, jewelry arts, sewing. There's food. It is just huge. And so there's something for just about everybody there. And it's just interesting to look at. And you just show up. There's like not an entrance fee or anything like, you know what I mean? It's just, they block off the streets, you know, a road, and they just, and, you know, you just go there and see. And and it's really interesting. And there's food. They have food vendors there and stuff. And so that's kind of, you know, it's, you know, you got a variety there. And so it's a good way to spend an afternoon.
And then July 24th, you're going to be at River City Con in Marietta, Ohio.
Yeah, the Comic-Con there.
The Comic-Con down there. Now, have you done many Comic-Cons in the past? Or?
I've only done that one. And it's a small one. It's not huge. It's not like the San Diego or something
or
like
Wizard
that.
Wizard World or whatnot. Yeah,
I've done,
sure.
Yeah. And it's kind of small, but it's fun. It's fast. It's one day. They have like a... They have like a costume contest and they've got, you know, comic books and they've got artists there. I mean, you know, it's just a smaller version.
And with those two particular dates that are coming up in the next couple of weeks, you'll have all your novels there, correct?
Yes,
for sale?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So
And I believe at River City, Stephen Hines, who you interviewed a short while back, certainly. I think he's going to be there.
He is going to be there. And then finally, the last date, September 10th, which is a few months away, but you're going to be at the Pony Wagon Days Festival in St. Paris, Ohio.
Yes, yes, I will. And I've got stuff all the way out till March. I've got the plastics, you know.
I saw that.
I kind of try to schedule as much as I can. You know, and some events you have to apply to, and you don't know if you're going to get to go to or not. And sometimes, like, I've gone to the Con Carolinas.
Okay.
And I wasn't able to go this year.
Okay.
And I, because my daughter was graduating that weekend. That's kind of important. That's one of those priorities.
Yeah. You know,
sorry, honey. Can you send me a few digital pics or something?
Yeah, exactly. well, hey, if you want to know anything about Terry's schedule, your website is Ervin, ervin-author.com.
Correct.
And you also have a blog as well, upandaroundthecorner.blogspot.com. Correct?
Yeah, if you go to the website, you can find
there's
a link to it, vice versa.
Okay, so if you want to know where Terry's going to be, just definitely head on over to his website. Final thing that I overlooked, and I just saw it here in my notes, Flank Hawk, available in Spanish.
Yes.
How'd you feel when you got the news, Terry, we're going to put it out in Spanish?
Well, I thought it was kind of neat. My verbal capabilities in Spanish is about toddler level.
Yeah, well.
So, you know, that was something my publisher did.
Okay.
Okay, and so then he arranged for the translator.
Okay.
But then he also had somebody look over the initial translator's work. You know, he had several people who are very fluent in Spanish.
Right.
That read it to make sure it's a good translation, because how the heck am I going to know?
Right,
how
exactly.
the heck he does?
Yeah.
So that's things that a publisher does for you.
Yeah.
I can't say it sold a lot of copies. You know,
I was just going to ask that. I was like, did they?
It's hard for me to market.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's what my next question was going to be. Did they tell you? We think a Hispanic audience is really going to like this book, so we're going to put it out in Spanish. Or
no, give it a try,
okay,
and see what happens.
Okay,
you know, and he tried several other books, and some of them done a little bit better, some of them not so good.
Okay,
you know, from his publishing line, but you know, I don't know how hard he's going to pursue it.
Sure,
You know, and so
Relic Tech's not coming out in German next month, is it?
No, not that I know of. But you know, some authors have done it and done very well,
right.
And some don't. And I don't know.
All right. Well, Terry, thanks for coming on, man.
Well, thanks
I really
for inviting
appreciate it.
Me.
And again, I'm gonna throw it out there. Visit you over at your website, ervin-author.com.
Yeah, and if anybody there, you can contact me through there if you ever got any questions about writing or my books or anything like that.
There you go. There you go. All right. Well, thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you very much. We're handshaking.
We're handshaking. I don't know why, but anyway.
Well, because we're talking to each other, you know.
I don't know why we're doing this on a podcast and no one can see, but that's okay. You know?
Well, that's why we told.
You know, I use air quotes all the time, and then I go, I'm an idiot. Why am I doing air quotes? Nobody can see them. But anyways, hey, I'm going to throw it to a quick break, and on the other side of that break, I'm going to wrap up this episode. So please stick around. There you go, ladies and gentlemen, my conversation with author Terry W. Ervin II. I hope that you found it an interesting one. I had a blast recording this episode because I found Terry to be a very insightful gentleman. I found it very interesting to talk to him about the way in which he creates his craft and, you know, talk about his projects. And heck, we even talked a little bit about politics, too. But definitely, if you need any information whatsoever about Terry or about his novels, all you got to do is go to ervin-author.com, ervin-author.com. There you can find out about all of his different novels and his publisher, which I believe I may have mispronounced at the beginning of this episode, by the way, Griffin Wood. But you can find out about his schedule. You can find out how to get in contact with him about his various different postings on other blogs, even his own blog. And heck, if you are a little bit confused, you don't want to try to remember his website, just go over to my website, pbdcast.com, the official online home for John Orlando. And in the links section, I'm just going to post a link right there. So wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, as they would say. There you go. Let me talk about another upcoming event
that's happening here that I think you need to know about. And it is the return of New Ohio Wrestling. July 23rd, that's a Saturday. That's when their next big event is going to be. It's going to be held in Groveport, Ohio at the Alliance Center for Athletic Excellence, which is located at 5710 Greenpoint Drive North, Suite A. The doors open at 6. Bell time is at 7 p.m. You want to catch some great wrestling action? Come on out and check out NOW July 23rd. So far, they have several matches already signed. You have the Appalachian Outlaw. Jock Sampson is going to be taking on Uriah Baylor. No Shame, Jimmy Shane and Robbie Superstar are going to take on the tag team known as Generation Iron. Lau will be taking on Sherman Tang. Now, I don't believe that's my good friend, author Brian Lau. I'm pretty sure that's not him. But anywho, Juice Jennings is going to take on Justin Maine. True Grit Bruce Gray will be battling Marion Fontaine. The professional Brandon Fields will be taking on Onyx. And, of course, the big main event, Dark Star Matt Taylor taking on the Big Bear Benjamin Boone. All of that will be happening in Groveport, Ohio, July 23rd at the Alliance Center for Athletic Excellence. It's kind of a little bit of a tongue twister, if you will. But New Ohio Wrestling back in action. Definitely check out their Facebook page. Definitely check them out online as well on Twitter, at New Ohio Wrestling. And, you know, again, we're talking about the links page to pvdcast.com. We'll just go on over there because I have all their information as well right there at your fingertips. So, it's about time in this episode of this podcast for me to drop on you Orlando. There you go. You hear the music, you know that it's my turn to tell you about something that I think is cool, something that I think you should check out, something that I'm pretty excited about. And it is going to be another fabulous film that I've just recently watched. For this episode, I am going to talk about a documentary that is currently on Netflix. It's a documentary entitled Electric Boogaloo, The Wild, Untold Story of Canon Films. Now, you may say to yourself, John, I don't know what the heck that is. Well, Canon Films was a film company who, in the 80s, produced some major hits and some major duds. They are the film company that are behind just a few of these great epic films, such as Breakin', and of course, Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, Invasion USA, Missing in Action 2, Death Wish 2, 3, 4, 5, Over the Top, Masters of the Universe, and I can go on and on and on. But nonetheless, it is an absolutely amazing film. If you're a movie buff like I am, you need to check this out, and you need to do it right now. I'm serious. Like, as soon as you finish this podcast, you need to go fire up Netflix and sit down and watch it. It's amazing. It's just such a crazy tale of how these two renegades in Hollywood made some of the most iconic movies and some of the most crappiest movies ever. Check it out. Electric Boogaloo, The Wild, Untold Story of Canon Films. All right, well, that being said, it's time for me to wrap this thing up and get on out of here. So I want to tell you where you can get in touch with me. If you'd like to shoot me an email, please do so. You can simply just send it on over to johnorlando@pvdcast.com. You can follow me on Twitter at PVDMVP. That's also the same place on Instagram where I can be found. Same username, PVDMVP. Tell a friend about this podcast. As you know, it's also available on Stitcher Radio. It's also available on SoundCloud where you can download them right there to whatever device you'd like to use to listen to podcasts. Those two areas, of course, are not the only areas where you can pick up this podcast because, let's be honest, let's go right to the source. Get it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Go to pvdcast.com and you can listen there as well. More avenues coming shortly, I promise you that. So with that being said, I'm going to get on out of here. So I want to thank you for listening and I want to thank you for supporting this podcast. And I will chat at each and every one of you later.